Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Historians are warning that some ancient British structures are being threatened by climate change. One of the most affected places is around the Orkney Islands, which are off the northern coast of Scotland. The area is home to more than 3,000 historical places. But the islands have been severely affected by rising sea levels, heavy rainfall, and severe weather events in recent years. Evidence has been found around the Orkney Islands that humans lived there as far back as 8,500 years ago. Some structures on the islands were built during the Iron Age, Viking rule, and the Middle Ages. Archaeology experts have estimated that about 1,000 historical sites are under threat. One of those identified is the Iron Age building Southow Brock on the island of Rousey. Now the sea has eaten away much of the site's western area. The main wall has started falling into the sea. Julie Gibson is with the University of the Highlands and Islands. She told Reuters news agency that she fears the whole structure will one day completely disappear. Each year, a little more falls as the sea batters it, Gibson said. She said experts have discovered in recent years that all of the settlement archaeology in the area is within 100 meters of the coast edge. So as the sea takes this heritage of ours away, it's taking all that we have, she said. A few hundred meters away from Southow Brock is Midhow Brock. This Iron Age building is still in good condition because it has been protected by a seawall built in the 1930s. But experts say even this site faces risks if climate conditions continue to worsen. A climate risk report for the Orkney's historical sites was published in July by the environmental group Historic Environment Scotland, or HES. The group described the possible effects of climate change on sites as extreme, with a high level of vulnerability. HES reported that the average precipitation rate has risen 27% in Scotland since the early 1960s. During the same period, winter precipitation has increased more than 70% in parts of northern Scotland, it found. Wetter weather means buildings stay wet longer. This increases the chances of water entering deeply into structures and causing damage. The precipitation also can harm metal parts of buildings and lead to the ground becoming unstable. Over time, such damage can cause structural collapse. I'm Brian Lynn. Thank you.
Training is over for the day, but one Boston Celtics basketball team coach is still working. Assistant coach Kara Lawson is on the team's court, helping new player Carson Edwards improve his game. He gets the ball into the basket several times and then runs over to her. "Thanks, coach," Edwards says before exchanging a high five with Lawson. Welcome to the new look of the National Basketball Association, or NBA, the men's professional basketball league in North America. Women now are involved in most parts of the organization, from broadcasting, officiating, and coaching, to high-level management and even team ownership. Lawson is one of a record-high 11 women serving as assistant coaches among the 30 NBA teams. "It's not a fad," said former professional basketball player Nancy Lieberman. "It's opportunities going to very accomplished women who have given their life to the game." The change in the NBA is recent. The 61-year-old Lieberman remembers a time when women were rarely seen in the NBA. Lieberman herself has broken barriers as a player, as a coach in the WNBA, as head coach in an NBA minor league, and as an assistant in the NBA. She says she quickly learned that building relationships was critical to easing gender barriers in the organization. She found support from organization members, like former coach Don Nelson. In 2009, he chose Lieberman to be head coach of the minor league Texas Legends team. Now, she serves as an assistant coach for the Sacramento Kings, along with two other women. Players respect the women assistant coaches for their experience and knowledge of the game. Kara Lawson was a basketball star at the University of Tennessee and later won a WNBA championship with the Sacramento Monarchs. She also won a gold medal with the U.S. women's basketball team at the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, China. She retired from play in 2015. Earlier this year, she joined the Celtics as a coach. Player Gordon Hayward said Lawson has made her presence felt. "She's been good as far as just the experience she has as a basketball player," Hayward said. "Having someone that well-versed in basketball, that experience is good."
A majority of Americans say they are not satisfied with the nation's education system. They also have little hope that public schools will improve anytime soon. That information comes from a public opinion study released earlier this month. John Della Volpe directed the poll for Real Clear Politics. The poll asked registered voters about their thoughts and expectations of K-12 education. K-12 schools are kindergartens, elementary, and secondary schools. Volpe told VOA that Americans have major concerns about the quality of K-12 schools.
And they expect and will soon be demanding more from elected officials at all levels of government.
Volpe says the majority of voters believe the current education system is performing only fair or poor. Only a small number, 8%, say it is excellent. People do not have a lot of hope for improvement either. Most people answered that they do not think American schools will be a model for the world in the next 20 years. The United States, Volpe says, has a long way to go in order for us to lead the world in quality education. Public schools in the U.S. provide education from kindergarten through 12th grade. They are generally free for students. Each of the 50 states manages its own public school system. Financial support for public schools comes from state and local governments. The federal government provides a small percentage of the money needed, too. Much of the money comes from local property taxes, so there are often differences between schools in wealthier neighborhoods and those in poorer areas. Volpe said people's beliefs about their schools are highly connected to how much money they make.
You are 3.5 times more likely to believe you are in a good school district or that education will be better in the future in a standard for others to follow if you come from a household who has income of $150,000 or more, relative to those who earn less than $50,000.
Because of this, he says, there is a rising sense of not only economic inequality in this country, but educational inequality. The researchers asked study participants what they want public schools to provide children. The participants chose from a list of 15 possible priorities. The top answer? Schools should teach students to read and write. Next was to teach them to be good citizens. The third most important priority was to keep students safe from violence and physical harm. Preparing students to enter the workforce and giving them knowledge of American history came in fourth and fifth. Only about half of the participants said schools should prepare students for college. That choice came in 13th. In a time of great political division in the U.S., Volpe says, education is an exception.
K-12 education is one of very few issues where partisanship and ideology is not a major factor or a major driver.
People from both major political parties agree that the education system needs improvement. 51% of Republicans and 55% of Democrats rate American education as only fair or poor. K-12 education is an important issue for voters, but it has not received much attention so far in the 2020 political election cycle. Instead, politicians have debated about higher education, such as whether colleges and universities should be free. Volpe says the poll shows that education is an issue that will be important in 2020.
I think the politicians and the candidates are not making a priority, but I'm not sure that people are accepting that or will accept it any further. It is a top priority, and I think it can make a difference between candidates and the Democratic primary, certainly kind of in the general election.
I'm Ann Ball.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the election of Martin Van Buren as the 8th President of the United States. Van Buren had served as President Andrew Jackson's Secretary of State and later his Vice President. Jackson asked his political party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. The Whig Party was against him, but their opposition was divided. Van Buren won the election easily. Jackson stood beside Van Buren as the new president was sworn in at the Capitol building in Washington. Physically, the two men were very different. Jackson was tall, with long white hair that flowed back over his head. Jackson's health had been poor during the last few months he spent in the White House. He seemed tired. There was almost no color in his face. Van Buren was much shorter than Jackson and had much less hair. His eyes were brighter than those of the old man next to him. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren noted that he was the first American born after the Revolution to become President of the United States. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His family was Dutch. Van Buren said he felt he belonged to a later age. He called for more unity among Democrats of the North and South. He said better times were ahead for the country. Martin Van Buren had a poor education as a boy. He went to school only for a few years. His father was a farmer and hotel keeper at a small town in New York State. Politicians, including Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, had sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them and others, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended tenants and renters who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official and then a senator and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with. But she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with 4 sons.
And after that, he was known as quite charming among the ladies, as they said in those days.
Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. Mr. Silby says, most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his political life and his social life separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. But he did not have a national reputation like Andrew Jackson had.
What he was known for and what got him into the vice presidency and then the presidency was that he was Jackson's right-hand man.
Van Buren had been president for just a few days when an economic crisis struck the country. The crisis had been building for months. It really began with the death of the Bank of the United States more than a year before. The bank had been so strong that it was able to control the economy throughout most of the country. It also helped control smaller state banks. It refused to accept the notes or paper money of these banks unless the state banks could exchange the paper for gold or silver money. President Jackson had opposed the Bank of the United States. He vetoed a bill that would have continued it. After the powerful bank closed, a number of new state banks opened. All of them produced large amounts of paper money, many times the amount they could exchange for gold or silver. Business speculators used much of this paper money to buy land from the government. These men bought the land, held it for a while, then sold it for more than they paid. The government soon found itself with millions of dollars of paper money of questionable value. To stop these activities, Jackson had ordered only gold or silver payments for government land. But many banks did not have enough gold to cover the paper notes. At the same time, American agriculture was having trouble. In 1835 and 1837, many crops failed. American traders had to import farm products from Europe, and they had to pay for them in gold or silver. In the spring of 1837, just as Martin Van Buren was taking office, the demand on banks for gold and silver grew too heavy. The banks stopped honoring their promises to exchange their paper money for gold. They said the suspension was just temporary, that it was necessary to stop for a while all payments in gold or silver. The crisis became worse. Many of the weaker state banks closed. Those that stayed open had almost no money to lend. Businessmen could not pay back money they owed the banks, and they could not get loans to keep their businesses open. Many factories closed. Great numbers of people were out of work, and prices rose higher and higher. Most people struggled to buy food and other necessities. The price of flour and meat doubled between 1835 and 1837. Even coal, the fuel people used to heat their homes, cost two times as much. Violence finally broke out at a protest meeting in New York City. Some in the crowd demanded action against the rich traders. About 1,000 people marched to a store, forced their way into it, and destroyed large amounts of flour and grain. Businessmen blamed the government for the economic depression. They said the biggest reason was a decision former President Jackson made. Jackson's order required the government to accept only gold or silver for government land. Opponents said the order had caused fear and mistrust. Even some of Jackson's strongest supporters said it should be lifted. They said the measure had done its job of ending land speculation. Now, they said, it was hurting the economy. Two of President Van Buren's closest advisors urged him to continue the order. Lifting it, they argued, would flood the federal government with worthless paper money. Van Buren was troubled. The federal government had already lost $9 million because of bank failures. The president wanted to make sure the government had enough money. And he wanted this money safe until needed. Yet, he did not believe the federal government had the responsibility for ending the Depression. And historian Joel Silby says Van Buren did not believe the government had the right to interfere in any way with private business.
He said that over and over again, that the federal government doesn't have the power to do this.
Mr. Silby adds that Van Buren's political philosophy grew out of the beliefs of former President Thomas Jefferson. All of his life, Van Buren claimed to be a Jeffersonian Democrat.
That had very specific meaning to him. Limited government, freedom for people, meaning white males. He was an egalitarian within the limits of those years.
Van Buren also shared Jackson's suspicion of bankers. In general, he believed no group, neither the government nor the wealthy, should have too much power, not even to help the economy. So Van Buren decided to continue Jackson's order. No government land could be bought with paper money. The American economy got worse. The president called a special meeting of Congress. In a message to lawmakers, Van Buren said, "Overbanking and overtrading had caused the Depression." He proposed several steps to protect the government. One of them was for Congress to pass a law permitting the government to keep its own money in the Treasury. America's Treasury Department received money when it collected import taxes and sold land. It used this money to pay what the government owed. The Treasury did not, however, hold the money from the time it was collected to the time it was paid out. The Treasury put the money in private banks. President Van Buren wanted to end this custom. He wanted a law to let the Treasury keep government money in its own secure places. The Whigs criticized Van Buren for thinking only of protecting the federal government and not helping businessmen, farmers, and the states. Some Democrats, who believed strongly in states' rights, also opposed Van Buren's idea. All these opponents provided enough votes in Congress to defeat the proposal. Van Buren tried again the following year to get approval for an independent treasury. Again, the proposal was defeated. Finally, in June 1840, Congress passed a law enabling the Treasury Department to hold government money itself. Van Buren signed what was called the Independent Treasury Bill. But the economic depression continued. Martin Van Buren also faced an international challenge from a surprising place. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.